I'm glad to be here. Good to see you. It's you know, this last couple of weeks, last week I did a funeral for Debbie Seeger, who is a close friend of mine, who battled cancer for 9 years. And that was really rough. These are difficult times. And yesterday I did a funeral for a young man, Zach Brown, who's just 23, just turned 23 years old. And he died of cystic fibrosis and had an unbelievable battle. I think I can switch over now. Yeah, okay. Unbelievable battle and courage. Big family and his mom, dad, brothers, sisters, all there. And we're out in Soul Park. And just, you know, it's super. It's, you know, for me as a person, I look at Debbie. She was just in her 50s, you know, and husband, son, daughter, and then I look at this young man, Zach, 22, 23 years old, and just fought every day for breath. Right? If you don't know what cystic fibrosis is, it's a disease, a genetic thing that hits your lungs and prone to infections, and the infections lead to scarring, and the scarring is the fibrosis, and then cysts develop, and slowly you're just slowly choked out. I mean, where every breath becomes, and his girlfriend of 4 years gave a tribute to him that was just devastating in its beauty, and yet devastating. I mean, there was not a dry eye. I was emotionally wrung out. So it's funny. I say this because some people might catch me at a time where I might feel some things I say, it might come across as insensitive. Like a week like this, where I'm between two people so young who have died so tragically and slowly. If somebody comes up to me and says, gosh, you know, I'm not really sure I like the music, I'm kind of like, I don't care. I really don't care. I might not be the most sensitive person in that moment in the world when people have these kind of complaints. It warps me, and I admit that. That doesn't mean that you're not right or they're not. That's why I'm saying this is almost like an apology. A lot of times I'm a little warped because I deal and see with stuff on a daily, if not weekly, basis with people, their lives, their tragedy, their struggles that make little things that maybe are big things to somebody else seem really, 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 really little to me. And I don't always handle that right. And I apologize about that. But that's just something you should know. I want to talk this morning a little bit about, I think it's going to relate to us all. No, I know it's going to relate to us all. And I want to start by telling a story that's a very, very familiar story in the Bible. It's about a king, King David, considered Israel's greatest king 3,000 years ago. And David, most of you are familiar with the David story, becomes king, slays Goliath, becomes king, and does an amazing job. And he's kind of on a roll when he encounters this woman named Bathsheba, or Bathsheba as we call her. And it's kind of funny the way that the story goes. It says, in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. So as the story unfolds in chapter 11, and it's just a bunch of different stories sometimes that are crammed together, it starts out very strange. It starts out very weird for a Jewish listener because it's spring and it's the time. It's like football season. Hey, it's springtime. We go out and let's do war. And as a king, David is supposed to be leading those troops, but he's not. He's taken a sabbatical. He's chilling back at the palace. He sends Joab out to go do it. And they go to battle of the Ammonites. They're always fighting somebody. And it says, one evening David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. Some of you have been with us to Israel. We've actually stepped and walked on those terraces that they've just excavated recently that we now know is David's palace. It doesn't look very palatial. It's actually a very small a dwelling and simple and stone. But you do get it because it's on the it's on the Kidron Valley. You do understand that the way his palace is terraced, he has a view from it. And it says, which is really interesting because you actually see that. He says, from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent someone to find out about her. And the man said, isn't that Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. And then she went back home. And the woman conceived and sent out a word to David saying, I'm pregnant. There is so much between the lines. When it says he sent for her, they brought her, he slept with her, he raped her. Okay? He used his position and power as king to rape this beautiful woman. And there's a bunch of levels where this gets very complicated that we can't go into. But he rapes her and then sends her off. And then the word gets back from her, I'm late. Whoa, it's a problem because nobody's supposed to know about this thing. And he's got a big problem. And then he starts to spin in his story. The next thing he does is he arranges for the murder of her husband. He has the husband come home. He tries to get the husband. He calls him from the field of duty. And Uriah is given kind of a leave of absence from battle, and he's allowed to be with his wife. And what he's hoping is that he's going to sleep with his wife. And then that way we can say the pregnancy is now, he gets out of the clear. But the guy's got so much character. He's like, dude, I cannot come home on leave of absence and lounge around with my wife while my men are fighting. And he refuses. And he doesn't do it. So he's in a jam. And David escalates the whole deal. And he actually has him murdered. And then she is now a widower. And then David has her brought to the house again. And he marries her. And that way he thinks, I've covered it. He's married this widow woman. He's allowed, you know, biblical times you're allowed to have multiple wives. And he took her on as a wife. She was a widower. And he thinks he's got the story covered that way. But it doesn't really go that way. The cat gets out of the bag. And Nathan is an amazing prophet. He understands and knows what's happened. And he ultimately confronts David, calls him out, and he rebukes him. And we get this weird passage where David just absolutely is crushed because he got into this thing. It just began to spin. And Nathan tells him this story about a guy. He's coming to him to act as judge, as a king would. He said, there's this guy, a great unrighteousness has been done to him. He has had all his sheep and stuff stolen by this rich guy, and he only had one sheep left, and the guy stole that from him too. And David is so incensed, he said, this guy should die for what he's done. Surely, as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. And he's going off on how this guy deserves to die. And then Nathan says, dude, you're the guy. You have everything, and you stole this man's wife, and then you murdered him. Now, some of you may be familiar with this story, and if it doesn't shock you again, it should, because we're talking about King David, who is described in the Bible as a man after God's own heart. And at that moment that he's confronted, and the cat comes out of the bag, he, of course, freaks out. And the judgment is pronounced on David by Nathan. And David says to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. Now, what can he expect? Well, he can expect a double death penalty. Because the Torah, the Bible, is very clear. Adultery, stoned to death. Murder, death penalty. So this is where just one of those things where the Bible, like we think, oh, the Bible says, and da, 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 da. Apparently, even God doesn't care sometimes what the Bible says. Because right on the heels of that, he knows he's a dead man. Nathan says, the Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die. That's one of those moments where pastors like to just read right through it, and nobody ever puts on the brakes and goes, what? Wait, he violated Torah 2 times. He has a 2-time death penalty coming to him, and all of a sudden, what? God just took away his sin, and it's okay? And then it gets a little bit funkier, because we're like, well, that's weird. But he says, you're not going to die. But because by doing this, you have made enemies of the Lord, you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt. He says, you've made a laughingstock out of Israel. And the son that is going to be born to you, the son, the bastard child of the illegitimate relationship, he says, will die. Now, this is where you go, what? Wait a minute. So, David doesn't die for his sin, but an innocent baby is going to die? Is this the way God really works? And then in theology, we have to ask a big question. Is this descriptive or prescriptive of the events? In other words, is it a prescription to a particular type of sin? Is it guaranteed that when you have an illicit affair and a woman becomes pregnant in that affair and then she bears a child, that automatically that child is going to die? Well, we know that not to be true. But we still have a problem. And that's another whole sermon I don't got for you today. So I'm not going to answer that question, but it's a tough one. It's a weird one. It's full of weird stuff. A double death penalty is overlooked and an innocent baby is born and Nathan says the kid's going to die. Okay. But what about Bathsheba? And as a matter of fact, in a time of just discussion and sharing and talk, Leanne McDonald was sharing a little bit on her journal and she had some thoughts on that she had written down, and I wanted her to share them with us today because she kind of takes a look in her journal at some things, and I asked her this morning, last night, so give her some love for getting the call last night and say, hey, would you mind pulling out your journal and sharing for me? But I want you to speak right into that sucker because I don't want anybody to miss a word, and I want you to share a little bit your thoughts on that passage.
Okay, so just a little bit. This is where I found the freedom to really dive into the Bible for myself. Growing up in the church, you know, I was given all the stories, and, you know, you're given the stories, and then you're told what to think in the church I grew up in. And coming into this church, where there were a lot of questions, it gave me the freedom to start my own exploration. And this is a story that has challenged me personally in a lot of ways, but it gave me an entrance to kind of explore and question God and question God's words. So what about Bathsheba? She was bathing. David saw her. He wanted her. So he sent someone to go get her. He had her and gets her pregnant. So what about her story? Was she happy in her marriage? Did she love Uriah? What did she think and feel about the king watching her while she bathed? Did she really want to go be with David? She must have known what was coming when someone showed up and said, the king wants to see you. What were her choices? Go with the king? Defy the order and be ostracized? Singled out? Killed maybe? Did she know what the consequences might be of either choice? How did she feel? Scared? Afraid? Embarrassed? Exposed that he watched her bathe? Flattered, curious, intrigued, honored, doubt and shame knowing she would be with David while her husband was away, unfaithful, adulterous, victimized, violated? Did she even know what she felt? Was the experience too overwhelming to process? So she gets to the palace and he sleeps with her. That's a conveniently mild way to put it, I think. What of that? He knew she was married, that her husband was serving him at war, and one that he should have been at too. Did she even have a choice in this? He's king. What is she? A wife? A woman? Second class? Someone else's possession? A common person without great social status? Could she even have a choice with the power differential between them? So did he sleep with her, or did he rape her because she really couldn't say no under the circumstances? And then what? He sends her home. What did she feel then? Used, discarded, defiled, unfaithful, shame, anger, embarrassment, helplessness, confusion, pain, suffering? How did this encounter change her? So she gets pregnant, lets David know, and he tries to cover it up by bringing Uriah home to get together with his wife. But he doesn't even want her because he's more concerned with his troops than with his wife, and so much so that he doesn't even go home to her. So now she's essentially been discarded and rejected twice. What despair this must have created for her. What would happen when Uriah found out she was pregnant? He would know the child wasn't his. What would he do? Put her out? Divorce her? Have her stoned? And then the public humility and rejection? What would become of her? How would she provide for herself? How would she care for her child? Would she even live to have the child or be stoned as an adulteress? Uriah goes back to the war and is killed, murdered. Does she ever find out what exactly happened? Who was ultimately at fault for Uriah's death? Is she told any of it? And how does that change her experience of David? How could she love him, trust him? Here she's been raped and impregnated by him, and now he murders her husband and makes it look like he was killed in battle. Does fear, anger, resentment color the way she experiences David now? Fear that he might kill her or the child? And how does it affect her, carrying a baby because she was raped? Once the period of mourning is over, she's taken back to King David to be his wife. How long is the period of mourning? From the account, we know it's less than 9 months because the baby hasn't been born yet. Is that really enough time to grasp what has happened in her life and grieve for the losses? To process how one man's desire has turned her whole life upside down? How is it that she was merely there, going about her life, doing the best she could, and all the consequences of David's actions have affected her life? She's the one violated and then turned out. She's the one pregnant. It was her husband killed. And what of David? What loss has he suffered? Where are his consequences? How does all this, lust, infidelity, rape, murder, deception, cover up, reflect David as being a man after God's own heart? Where is God's grace for Bathsheba in all of this?
I've sat in churches for many years listening to the story taught. I never remembered a single story ever where a pastor asked and wondered, like, what was the whole situation like from the woman's perspective? What was Bathsheba's experience? And in our time talking, she brought that piece of the journal out, and I'm like, that's good. And Leanne, that is exactly the way I encourage people to study the Bible, to read the Bible. It's not just stories. I'm not just here to tell you a story. Then here's the points. Here's what you need to know. Here's right. Here's wrong. Here it is. Five bullet points. To really get into the truth of the situation is to absorb yourself into the characters and the people, because they're just living, breathing people like you and me. And we begin to see all kinds of things. We ask all kinds of questions. And that's okay to do. It's okay to wonder, what was that like? And it causes these great contrasts. David is considered a hero in the Bible, and he is. He is a man after God's own heart, and he's also an adulterer and a murderer. Okay, that's just something we have to face. And there are victims in there. And then you have like this innocent child that's born and given by God a late-term abortion, taken out. If that's really the way it goes, if we go by the literality of the text. But what happens here ultimately, and the reason I chose this text, is what happens here is something that happens to many of us in life, literally or figuratively in some way, devastation. Devastation hits. And what do we do when the devastation hits? And it can hit in a lot of different ways. I mean, something can come and creep into our life, and we find ourselves all of a sudden shattered and broken. It can be physical, it can be relational, it can be emotional, it can be sexual, it can be financial, it can be a lot of things, but all of a sudden the proverbial rock comes crashing through the glass house, and you're left with shards and shattered, and you're broken. What do we make of that? Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about brokenness this morning and try to understand it as a process that can lead to greater blessing in our lives. And yet it's something that is so delicate and sensitive, we have to really ask questions about that and wonder about that and not make statements about that. And you have to be allowed to think for yourself on this thing. When I think of breaking, I think of another story, a great story. It's a one I'm sure you're familiar with. It's the story of Peter. Peter was Jesus' right-hand man, the rock, stone, right? Petros, Kepha, Peter. And if you know Peter in the Gospels, he is fiery. I just envision him with just a big beard, big hair. He's a fisherman. I just see him as lean, ripped, tough, and rough around the edges. But my gosh, he is following Jesus, and he is passionately falling in love with Jesus, and his life is being revolutionized with Jesus. And yet, and so much so that at one point, Jesus says about Kepha, Peter, I say this also, this is in Matthew 16, that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Now that is such a misunderstood and twisted around verse. I got another whole sermon on it, but that's not my point. My point is simply, despite mistranslations of that verse, Peter's an important person. And in fact, we see Peter kind of takes the lead of the 12. But right on the heels of that, in Matthew 16, 22, just a couple, after a few words after Jesus tells Peter he's now got to go to, he tells him really what's happening. I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be crucified, handed over, all these things. And Peter, it says, Peter, check this out, this is Peter, right? Took Jesus aside and began to rebuke him. He took Jesus aside and began to rebuke him. The word is very powerful. It means like, yeah, Jesus, time out. Jesus, this is Peter. Jesus, we boys, I need to talk to Jesus alone. Come with me, Jesus. And then he just reads them the riot act. No way you're doing that. That's not going to happen. Are you? I mean, can you imagine? That's pretty bold, right? Going up to Jesus and telling him, no. You need to listen to me now. But that's Peter. And then we know at the Last Supper, Peter is also famous, right? Because Jesus does the foot washing in the Gospel of John. And Peter is so disturbed by this scene that the rabbi, that the master, would be down on his knees, stripped down like a common slave, washing feet, that when he comes to Peter, he says to him emphatically, I dare say even screaming it, you shall never wash my feet. Again, telling Jesus what he is or isn't going to do. Later on, after the Last Supper, Jesus makes the statement that they're going to fall away from him because some bad stuff is going down, and they're going to probably cut and run. And Simon Peter, it says, stood up and says, and he really disses the rest of the crowd, because he's there with the 12. If these other 11 yahoos leave you, which I could understand looking at them. I'm telling you, Jesus, I, Peter the Rock, will never, ever forsake you or leave you. He says that right to him, bold, right there, bam, Matthew 26, 33. They'll all fall away because of you. I will never fall away. And then in the Garden of Gethsemane, shortly after that, we know they come, he draws a sword. And true to his word, he begins to wing and he takes the ear off of Malchus, who must have just parried that blow, loses the side of his head. And he is like, this is not going to happen. Now we know the Peter story. Jesus is arrested. He's tried several times. And that's when Peter starts to panic. Things begin to unravel. And not once, not twice, but three times he's confronted by strangers saying, hey, aren't you a friend of Jesus? And not once, not twice, even the third time, it says he called to heaven and he says, listen, he says, may God damn me if I know the guy. May God just flat out damn me right now. He denies knowing him three times. And the way the narrative, the story is set up, is that just when that happens, as Jesus predicted he would, he said to Peter, oh man, you're going to fail me. And Peter's like, no! Jesus comes out of the courtyard hearing him saying, God damn me if I know this guy. And they meet eye to eye. And Jesus is like, see, I told you. And Peter shatters. He falls apart. He literally shatters. He is broken into a thousand pieces. It says he wept bitterly. It's that bitter weeping of the deep, 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 deep fractured soul. Right? What happens when we go through something in life that shatters us? What the death, the illness, the loss of loved ones? I see it all the time. Where do we go from there? What is the point? What is the purpose? Well, I think a few that I want to maybe just throw out. Some of the things that can come out of brokenness. First of all, I would like to clarify that I do not believe, as some do, that God does these things to us. Now, some people say that and they say, well, God's must be God's will, God's in control. Your husband died of cancer. It was a horrible long death, but you can trust that God's in control. And he's trying to teach you something of this. Oh, yeah. I'm all about the teaching something, learning something through the process. But I'm not one of the big fans of saying that, yeah, God is doing this to you. There's that famous Bible passage in Romans that says, all things work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purposes. Yeah, we always hear that. All things are working together for good. Your child's dead or it's got cystic fibrosis. I'm done. Praise God, because all things are working together for good. No, I don't buy that. Now, you may, and that's fine. I get that. We're allowed to have our differences of opinions. No, I don't buy that. And I don't think the text is actually saying that. It doesn't say that all things are good. It doesn't say all things are coming from God. It just is all things. And that can be good things, and it can also be the crappy things. He just says, when the crappy things happen, that God can do something with that if we seek him in the midst of it, or not. No, but there is an option. I don't like that qualification for those who love God, because I know that not to be true. I know plenty of people who I could say don't know or don't love God the way I think a person should or could, and yet they have had shattering in their life, and there has been amazing healing and bringing together and things learned that transformed the person. And here's where I go. This is what I can say about the brokenness that enters into our life. It can break us, shatter us, destroy us. I've seen it. It can also, and I believe this with God especially, I'm not objective, it can also be transformational for us. It can actually transform us into something we could never have imagined or done on our own had not these circumstances happened to us. I think it's possible, perhaps, things happen to us that are bad. Sometimes it's the choices we've made. Sometimes it's the bad choices others have made that affect us. I think what is possible is that if I'm in a pattern of making bad choices, I found myself in those positions many times in my life, and I found myself, as I look back with history, going, but for the grace of God, how did I make it through that situation? But for the grace of God, how was it that I was able to get away with that over and over and over again, right? I think sometimes, though, is that we are typically grace abusers. We think because we're dodging bullets that it's because of our reflexes and that we're really good. And then maybe, just maybe, instead of protecting us, maybe, just maybe, God says, you know what? You did this, and I'm going to let you experience the consequences of what you did. And bang, we're hit. And then what do? Do we stay down and out? Or do we allow the experience? I would say David was hit right between the eyes with a bullet. It's you, Nathan said. You are an adulterer and a murderer. You have done these horrific things. And then you would think and say, and God is through with you. He's going to take your kingdom away. You're a two-time death penalty person. Go to death row. And no, he comes out of it. That's kind of amazing. Peter, the same thing. Peter is broken. But it is in his brokenness, it is in his fracturing, it is when Peter and his ego and his boasting and his self-assurance and his confidence and his will and all those things literally fall to pieces like one of those Wile E. Coyote cartoons when he, runs into something and shatters into 1,000 pieces. It is from there, from that the rebirth of Peter takes place. And when Peter is literally reassembled, he comes together as a far more powerful human being than he ever was with all his testosterone and muscle and braggadociousness. He now becomes a man of God. In his weakness, as Paul says, he discovers strength. He finds the strength of God. He finds the presence of God. He finds the healing of God. He finds the kingdom of God where everything is back-asswards, where the last are first and the first are last, where the weak are powerful and the powerful are weak, where the humble are exalted and the proud are laid low. Everything, where you die only to be born again to a new life and a new path and a new way. It's a painful process. It's not something we ever wish upon anybody. But how many of us can look back at painful processes in our life and go, as the saying says, no pain, no gain. You don't become an athlete. You don't become a businessman. You don't become somebody without spending you don't get the Juris Doctorate. You don't get the PhD. You don't get the position as team captain, become an All-American simply by, I don't really work out much. As a matter of fact, I don't at all. I don't study my playbook. No, I'm just kind of cruising on confidence. No, it doesn't happen. I don't really need to study for the test. I think I'm just going to fly right through to that PhD. Mm-mm. No, it is the process. I mean, I think for most people who hire people with a degree, they don't really give a rip about the degree. Because quite frankly, honestly, in our system, the degree doesn't do much good in most cases. They just know that you can put up with a lot of crap. That's really what college is. Oh, you put up with 4 years of crap pretty good. All right, I think you might fit in our company. Because we got a lot of that going around. Yeah, So the purpose of breaking is to make us into something we're not. I wouldn't say the purpose of, I would say the byproduct of, can be. It can mature us. It can transform us. It can make us more useful. I find broken people, humble people, people who've got some life experiences become way more open because the whole world doesn't revolve around them anymore. They become less self-centered and they become other-centered. I think brokenness can give us, well, an attitude of perspective. That can be a double-edged sword. Trust me, it's like I say, I come back from a funeral from a 23-year-old kid. I'm not really interested in a lot of people's bullcrap. I'm just not. Well, I really think we should. I don't care. I got to go. I'm not trying to be insensitive, but you're just going to like, come on. Come on. Please, people, come on. It's not that big of a deal. Apparently, you don't know what a real big deal is, and God forbid that you're going to run into it. But if it helps you get a better perspective about life, then so be it. That is the wonderful, wonderful byproduct of it. We go through brokenness, and all of a sudden, our mind changes. We may never think about somebody with cancer until we experience it, and then all of a sudden, the world changes. It was so neat to see so many people with cystic fibrosis t-shirts on. They talked about what cystic fibrosis was. They brought an awareness at this memorial about what this kid had gone through. And you realize, and even as I met with the family in our private times, I was like, you know what? Out of this tragedy, A, you're not alone. Others are going through it and will go through it tomorrow. And nobody will understand the journey better than you. No one will bring better comfort or strength to them than you. Because you've been through it. You've been broken. You've got some fracturing. We begin to think all of a sudden in our brokenness, if we allow God to invade it, we begin to experience and see things the way God sees things. We can make up, you know, myths and stories about a King David. I'm so glad the Bible doesn't do that. See, if I were writing the Bible, I would have scratched that part. Yeah, if I'm the editor trying to create a really cool religion, I'm kind of like, yeah, my hero? No, scratch the murder adultery thing. Let's drop that from the final. Cut that to the editing floor. No. I appreciate the rawness. And you know why? Because I believe that's where the inspiration and the guidance comes from God's word, because it deals with it in its reality. Even with unanswered question. It shows us what we need to become. So I don't have the time to go much further than that thought. There is, however, something I want to show you before you leave that I think we'll talk about it. This is one. Beautiful vase created here. Kids at Nordoff.
It's an amazingly gorgeous glazed green vase that they use.
What is that firing, Jared? The paper? Or Josh? Say it loud. Is it Japanese? I think so, huh? Anyways, so it's a beautiful vase. It's a treasure. Oh, it's a really well-made vase. That's a tragedy. That is life, folks. You put a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of sweat into making something really, really beautiful, and then some Yahoo pastor comes along with a hammer and decides to fracture the beauty of the vase. In Japan, there's a story about a vase that gets fractured. It takes place in the 16th century. A very powerful shogun is having tea, and one of his attendants drops this precious bowl. Toyotomi Hideyoshi. And this takes place in the 1500s. And he drops this bowl, and everybody freaks out. The attendant is fearing for his life because it's literally, he's known for his temper. But there's this philosopher who happens to be having the tea with him, who on the spot puts together in the Japanese, I'm not even going to try to do the English translation because it just doesn't make sense much. He puts together this little poem, and the poem makes light of the moment.
and the angry shogun calms down. There's laughter, and the guy's life is saved. And he takes the pieces, and he asks to have them repaired. Nobody can repair him, so he decides to repair the bowl itself. And he makes a particular glue of a resin, and then he puts powdered or gold dust into the resin, and he mixes and he makes this glue with gold that adds to its strength and its beauty. And he puts the bowl piece by piece glued back together. This bowl exists to this day. It's considered in Japan to be a national treasure. And what he finds, this shogun, is that when the bowl is finished, it stands out and he sees it as being more beautiful than before it was shattered. And in Japan, this bowl stands as a talismanic proof that imagination and language had the power to make ill fortune good. Instead of the altered physical appearance of the bowl diminishing its appeal, a new sense of its vitality and resilience raised appreciation to even greater heights. Immaterial factors assumed a material presence through the lines of its mending and became an inextricable part of the bowl's appeal. One might also say the true life of the bowl, Tsutsui Sutsu, name of the bowl, began the moment that it was dropped. They literally use that language of the bowl being born again in magnificence. And the fractures that have now been healed, the cracks through this technique have brought the scars to be things of beauty. Jared, can you put the picture up of Kintsukuroi? So it's called Kintsukuroi today. And Kintsukuroi means literally the phrase to repair with gold. It's a distinctly Japanese art form, the art of repairing pottery with gold or silver lacquer, and understanding that the piece is more beautiful for having been fractured and broken. My kids and I are going to look forward to getting the gold and lacquered glue and putting this thing back together. And we trust it's going to be even more beautiful than it was before. So there's a method even behind the madness of fracturing the bowl, where the scars become gold. It's a super important part of the entire process of the Japanese tea party, of the tea ceremony it's huge in Zen. In Zen, Mushin, it's called, is often translated as no mind. In Zen, when you take part of this tea ritual, you're to empty your mind. It says, Mushin is often literally translated as the no mind, but it carries connotations of fully existing within the moment, of non-attachment, equanimity, amid changing conditions, removal from the desire to impose one's will upon the world, and the accidental fracture set in motion, acts of repair that accept given circumstances and work within them to lead to an ultimately more profound appearance. The only willfulness in the process is the effort to assist with the rebirth of something whose existence had been threatened, something that held value for others. Wow, that is just so powerful. So you have this tear ceremony and you have these cracked vessels, and they are just reminders of fragility and beauty, of brokenness and mending and healing. And for me, that just speaks to me of the way Jesus works. It speaks to me of the way God works in our brokenness and the way He repairs. And if we allow Him, He'll take our shattered pieces and He'll come together with a golden glue and He'll mend and He'll piece you back together, and the finished product at the end of that is something transformed and rebirthed. For whatever is fracturing you in your life, whatever has fractured you in your life, whatever is mended or unmended, whatever ugliness, whatever hammer came out of nowhere and did this, whatever you did to yourself, what others did to you, however it happened, there is a time now where we can put our life back together using the golden glue of God. And you can be transformed into something more beautiful than you were before. You don't wish it upon anybody. You don't even want to volunteer to go through it. That's insanity. The point is, the hammer hits. It just does. It just will. Sooner or later, it hits. Where do we go from there? I would say offer up the brokenness to God and let Him glue you back together into something even more beautiful. I'm not going to forget the offering this Sunday. Who's doing it? Diane? Steve? All of you? The whole band? Why don't you come up while I take a moment to pray. God, thank you for this morning. Thank you for this time together. Thank you that you could take a person like David, who had just shattered himself through his own choices and vices, and yet, God, you came and you glued him back together. God, thank you that Peter, the last thing he expected to do was to deny you three times, and then he fell apart only to be put back together again by you. God, whatever it is in our hearts and our lives and our experiences, whatever it is yesterday, whatever it is today, whatever it is tomorrow, God, we offer these pieces to you and we ask you to mend us and fill us and make us even more useful than we were before. We ask this in Jesus' name. There's this amazing passage where Paul, the follower, Shaul, Saul, the follower of Jesus, who had pursued Jesus and killed his followers, was transformed, shattered, literally died to himself and was remade into Paul, who shared the love of Jesus with the world. But he also had issues. He had shattering. At one time, he had something that nobody knows what it is, and that's what's so beautiful, because it could be whatever it is for us. Something that he pleaded to God with to take it away. Take it away, take it away. And he heard in his spirit God simply say to him, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." And that's why he says, "For Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and insults and hardship and persecution and difficulties. For when I'm weak, then I am strong." I pray that the peace of God, the glue of God, would be called upon in your life to take the parts that are broken and mend them back together to make you into that beautiful creation who He knows you are to be. All right? May the peace, the grace, and the love of Jesus be with you all. All right. Nice. Yes.